Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Doris Flores Brooks, and I would like to officially call the public hearing on the proposed procurement rules and regulations for under the Office of the Public Auditor. We're here to gather testimony for the public as to the proposed rules and regulations. I'd like to just kind of give, for the benefit more of the hearing, to give a little bit of background information of how this came about. Public Law 2868, more commonly known as the FY06 Budget Act, gave the responsibility of procurement appeals to the Office of the Public Auditor. Prior to that, there was a Procurement Appeals Commission. However, the commission did not fully have members on board, and therefore it really was not in the position to act formally and take appeals. So in the interest of moving forward into this very important area, the senators of the 28th Guam Legislature designated the Office of the Public Auditor to be the procurement appeals. With that, they provided us a separate appropriation. This is a collateral responsibility of the Office of Public Auditor. And what we did was then hired an attorney, Ms. Therese Terwahi. She has a lot of experience. Therese came on board effective March 1st. She brings with her not only private sector experience, but more importantly, government sector experience, having served for over a dozen years as the majority as well as minority legal counsel of the Guam, various Guam legislatures. So we're very pleased that Therese has joined us. And with that, our rules have been posted on the internet since mid-May, and are here to take testimony. People can submit testimony in person, in writing, via email. In fact, we have received some testimonies thus far, and we're here to seek additional testimony. And with that, we'll open it up, and I'll turn it over now to Therese, who is officially the procurement hearing officer.
Thank you. Okay, for the record, I'd just like to make some notes here, and that is that the notice for this hearing was published on May 21 and May 26 in both the PDN and the Marianas Variety. The notices for the hearing were also delivered to the governor, the lieutenant governor, the speaker, and all senators of the Guam Legislature, the Guam Bar Association, all agency heads of the government departments, autonomous agencies, and public corporations, the Office of the Attorney General, the compiler of laws, the Guam Contractor License Board, and the Policy Office. Notice was also posted, as Doris said, on the OPA website, www.guamopa.org, and the public had the opportunity to review the rules at the OPA office or on the website since May 17. Prior to this hearing, written comment was submitted by Senator Tony Impinco, and testimony was submitted via email by Phil Isaac, Assistant AG, Sandra Cruz of Miramar, Spade & Thompson, Dana Gutierrez-Regis of Miramar, Spade & Thompson, Serge Tang of the Compiler of Laws, and Vicky Renasha of UOG. After today's hearing, we will continue to accept testimony for about 7 days, and then we intend to transmit this to the legislature. So after that, testimony should be transmitted directly to the legislature. Those presenting oral testimony today will be recorded so that we can make a transcript of this hearing. So without further delay, when I receive oral testimony from Mr. Anthony Camacho. He's also provided written notes. If anybody would like a copy to follow along, there's some up here.
Anthony, if you wouldn't mind, for the record, just cite your full name and your position, and then go into your testimony.
Yes, I'm Anthony Camacho. I am the staff attorney for the CCU, the Guam Power Authority, and the Guam Water Works Authority, and I'm testifying today on behalf of those three agencies. I first want to begin by commending the Office of the Public Auditor for the great work that have been undertaken. I've been in the procurement, the practice of procurement law now for almost 10 years. This is the first time that we have the administrative adjudication part of procurement appeal protests. So, and also on the short period of time that you've had the authority to do this, the creation of these rules just takes us light years ahead and propels the practice of procurement law exponentially. And I want to thank the Office of the Public Auditor, and especially the new counsel and the procurement hearing officer for all the fine work done on the rules. I reviewed the rules from back to back, all 15 pages of them, to include the exhibits and the draft documents. Some notes in terms of some of my thoughts, at least. In section 12102A, which essentially describes the jurisdiction of the public auditor, I note that this particular section closely tracks it. It's not identical to language in the OPA's statute or enabling statute authorizing her to hear procurement appeals. However, the language that states no prior determination shall be final and conclusive as it applies to the agencies. There is language in other statutes, though, that states essentially that some determinations made by the procurement officers or the heads of agencies are essentially final and conclusive unless they are clearly erroneous, arbitrary, capricious, or contrary to law, which means that someone protesting those specific actions would have to make a showing that they were final, conclusive, and erroneous, arbitrary, or contrary to law. We simply ask that the OPA amend this particular section to harmonize those statutes by including that standard. And for the record, I know I hate regurgitating numbers off books, but they're stated as I'm quoting 5 GCA section 5480 and also 5 GCA section 5703, or correction, 5 GCA section 5480B, which talks about limited finality for administrative determinations. And this comes from the statute that essentially waives sovereign immunity in connection with contracts. This essentially authorizes members of the public to protest procurement actions made by the government of Guam or the autonomous agencies or public corporations. And essentially, the specific decisions here that have that type of finality are decisions concerning requirement for bid security. Whenever a procurement officer makes a determination that no requirement for a performance bond in a solicitation, or when a procurement officer makes a sole source procurement determination, or when there is a determination for emergency procurement, or when there's a determination of best qualified professional and competitive selection procedures for procurement. Also, when there's a determination of non-responsibility, or when there's a determination that cost or pricing data from a contractor not to be required. Likewise, when there's a determination of type of contract to be used, or when there's a determination of approval of contractor's accounting system, and when there's a determination to use a multi-year contract. In this particular statute, we simply ask that that language, that these types of determinations are final and conclusive unless they're clearly erroneous, contrary to arbitrary, capricious, or contrary to law, be added in, or just to harmonize all the existing statutes. I think we have those anyway.
Just as a point of clarification, mm-hmm. Translate from what you just said.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Into simple language. I think, and yeah, Anthony can correct me if we're overstating here, but we've set a standard that no prior determinations are final or conclusive. His comment is that by statute, there are some determinations made by the agencies or procuring officers that are that should be final and conclusive unless erroneous, arbitrary, capricious, or contrary to law. And I think we can harmonize these, as you've asked to do, by by stating these exceptions and stating a different standard for these types of review of these determinations, or just recognizing them,
yeah,
that these exist and that we should follow the
rules. Yeah, bear with me. That's all related to the larger legal theory of review of agency determinations, okay? Basically, those are sovereign immunity. These are things that lawyers like to argue in the wee hours of the night.
But let me just ask this question, because I come here more as a layperson, for, let's say, an appellant who disagrees with, let's say, a ruling or a determination made to a vendor, that appellant might view the decision as erroneous,
mm-hmm,
or arbitrary or capricious. And whose burden of proof then is it to decide that? Because from his lay perspective, not knowing all the details, the mere fact that he lost this, he might be of a different set, that the decision made was already erroneous or was capricious, because let's say vendor A always gets the contract and he's trying to bid on the contract and he still didn't get it. Do you follow what I mean?
Yes, I do. Uh-huh. I do.
So how do we distinguish that? Because to the vendor's mind,
the statute means is that the vendors would have to claim that's true, that it was erroneous, capricious. That would have to be one of their allegations. If they just said it was wrong, possibly,
yeah,
that wouldn't go anywhere. But they'd have to make one of these allegations, and then we'd have to determine if that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Whether it was erroneous.
Okay.
We review that again. The agencies review that during the protest.
Yeah, that's pretty important for an agency to respond. For example, if the protester says, well, it's contrary to law and nothing else, it's like, okay, well, how do I answer that? Do I have to go through every single law that applies and show how it applies?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if they're alleging that, you know, we violated the law somehow, they should at least make a showing. I think we violated this statute.
Okay.
You know,
just rather than a broad brush.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And likewise, if they're saying it was arbitrary and capricious, well, mm-hmm, there are different ways to respond to that as an agency,
mm-hmm,
and it would help us, you know, from the agency perspective, if we knew exactly, at least for these particular determinations, well, say it's wrong. Why do you think it's wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's pigeonholed in one of these, at least that allows us to answer more specifically,
and it
would also make for a more expedited hearing. I know we'd be making all these motions for clarifications, mm-hmm, or, you know, we can't respond until we have more information.
So what I hear you saying is you would like the appellant or the vendor who did not get the award to be more specific as to as to his alleged wrong.
Well, that's correct. Generally,
rather than just say I didn't get it right and it was done unfairly.
The procurement law states that a protest has to be in a certain form. When it gets to our level, before it ever gets to you, for example, they have to state the grounds of their protest. And in doing that, though, I guess by the time it gets to your level, they should clearly state whether or not our final determination is arbitrary, capricious, contrary law, so on and so forth. You talked a little bit about burden of proof. I was going to get to that as we go on. But for now, I'm just going to continue on here. I crossed out section 12102B mm-hmm, simply because that was there erroneously. That closely tracks the language of the statute, so we have no issue with that. 12103B, I believe there's a grammatical error in 12103B, and that is that where it defines interested party,
mm-hmm,
this makes more sense if the fourth sentence, the or, should be and.
Right before number two?
Yeah, right before number two.
Okay, well, that makes a big difference.
Yeah, well, it does, but it just makes more sense that way.
Okay.
It's like maybe agreed, by the solicitation or word of a contract. By the protest or appeal, and who filed a protest or appeal.
Okay. That word, he's proposing or to be and?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they had to do one and two as opposed to one or two?
That's correct.
Correct, that's okay.
Well, here...
By putting an and, is that making it harder for the appellant as opposed to easier?
Well, it makes... It clearly identifies...
Because you have to have two things to comply as opposed to one thing.
Well, that goes to, okay, generally, one of the things I see with the rules, I'll discuss this later in mm-hmm. certain sections, is that it's kind of expansive when it allows interested parties to do things like file a rebuttal, present evidence. The reason being is if you define interested party broadly, okay, you bring in people who didn't file a protest. One of the defenses is if you didn't file your protest in accordance with the statute, you have no standing in the hearing to decide the protest. Now, it's another story if one of the parties, either the protester or the agency, subpoenas another interested party, like another bidder, for example, to come forth and bring testimony. But I don't believe that allowing an interested party, you know, just someone who submits a bid, but the 14 days goes by from the action, and they don't file a protest, have a second bite at the apple, like, oh, okay, this other guy filed a protest timely, so I'm going to, you know, take advantage of his timeliness and his work and submit my rebuttal to whatever the agency is doing. There's a fundamental fairness issue there. Likewise, there's also a due process issue there, in that a protester is clearly defined. It's one who files an appeal. So an interested party, I guess, as defined here, is very broad. It's anyone who has an interest in the solicitation of the award of the contract. Basically, if there's 10 bidders and only one files a protest, the way this is worded, and in combination with the other sections you have here, would allow all the bidders, for example, to submit rebuttals to the agency's response to the protest instead of just the protestor. That's the way that the other statutes read.
That is how it is.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I understand. I understand your point. That's mm-hmm. also been made by some of the other customers.
So, what's the... So is that good or bad?
That's the agency.
So it's good for the public, right? Well, uh-huh. the other I guess issue that was raised is that that allows other bidders who have not protested to gain access, possibly to negotiations or materials that they weren't normally going to access.
That's correct too.
Yeah. So we'll consider those.
Okay.
Okay, but we'd ask that interested parties going to be expanded in this way, that the interested party not be allowed to participate in the hearing unless they're specifically subpoenaed by one of the parties or by the OPA.
Okay.
Going on.
Point well taken. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And going on in section 12104B6, which concerns contract disputes.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, I noted that if the OPA, I know that the statute allows the OPA to hear the appeals of final determinations for contract disputes. I noted that there are a couple other sections of the existing administrative regulations or procurement regulations that would require amendment to harmonize the OPA's power. For example, in 2 GAR Division 4, Chapter 9, Section 9103, subsection D2E, please bear with me, that's just its number.
Yes.
For contract disputes, it says that notice of final decision by the procurement officer must include the statement, you may obtain judicial review of this decision by, in fact, granting it at the beginning. Beginning an action in the Superior Court of Guam. I recommend that be amended also to state by beginning an action with the Office of the Public Auditor.
Yeah, we made note of that.
And then the other one is 2 GAR Division 4, Chapter 9, Section 9103, subsection B3i. It requires a mandatory dispute clause to be in every government contract. Okay, and that clause, that mandatory clause, states that the decision, this is for contract disputes now, the decision of the procurement officer or final conclusions unless fraudulent, or the contractor brings an action seeking judicial review of the decision of the Superior Court of Guam. That last section should be amended to read 2 seeking administrative review of the decision of the Office of the Public Auditor. Just so there's no no issue there. That, clearly, it just it brings these two statutes or regulations up to date.
These are, by the way, these types of regulations that you're recommending, we intend to write a letter to the legislature and tell them what has been pointed out to be inconsistent in other regs or in the law also that need to be fixed. But, of course, we have very limited jurisdiction here in this public hearing, so but that's why we'll take all of these, we'll include them in the, when we submit it to the legislature.
I just know they have used two conflicts to exist, and it's certainly not the OPA's fault. It's another statute, another reg.
So we appreciate you pointing it out. Thank you.
And then Section 12104C2, where it talks about the head of the purchase agency shall furnish copies of the appeal documents to interested parties, bidders, or officers, which are essentially bidders or offers, with instructions to communicate further directly with the public auditor. That goes to including all interested parties to have a say.
Yeah.
You know, kind of broad. The other problem is it kind of conflicts with the existing procurement statutes or and regulations, which require, I guess, the agencies to identify the procurement officer. Okay, so if it's an ongoing procurement and there is a protest, and it's at the OPA level, but they have, I guess, a question generally about the procurement, they should still direct their inquiries to the procurement officer. If they have a question or inquiry concerning the procurement appeal, certainly that is one thing the OPA should be answering. So I ask if that be a little specified, or that be specified and limited to the inquiries concerning the status of the appeal. Because in a lot of cases you're going to have appeals where the procurement action is still pending, and certainly we still want to preserve the integrity of the procurement process for those procurement actions. And this goes to the other statutes which require, for example, procurement officer to keep a log of all communications with the bidder, so on and so forth. It also helps our record keeping if, as far as procurement goes, or the procurement itself, that they still are being made to communicate with the procurement officer. 12104C3, this is essentially, after there's a procurement appeal to the OPA, then the head of the purchasing agency may file a detailed agency report. So I guess it's one of semantics. For most lawyers, we're used to complaint and an answer. Okay. Detailed agency report is, in essence, our answer, the agency's answer to the appeal itself. I ask a detailed agency report should be amended to read answer. That's all, because everybody knows what an answer is. And detailed agency report, and like I said, it's just a matter of semantics. We have a preference for answer. And the other problem we had was the requirement that the agency respond to the appeal within 5 working days after receiving the notice of the appeal. The OPA, I guess, is required to decide these impartially, meaning to say they neither favor either party. They want to decide it in accordance with the law and with the existing rights of the parties. This kind of makes it very difficult and very challenging for an agency to respond to a protest. And the reason why is the appellant, essentially, for a protested solicitation or award of a contract, has 14 days under the law to get their stuff together and actually file that complaint. That's 14 days of work. Likewise, for a debarment or suspension proceeding, the appellant would have 60 days to prepare that complaint. And for a contract or breach of contract controversy, that's another 60 days for them to prepare the complaint. Some of these procurement actions are very complex, at least for GPA and GWA, especially when they involve construction. Okay, they're not simple bids. They're not simplistic contracts. And they involve sometimes millions of dollars. For us to respond to something that the other party had 14 days or 60 days to prepare and give us only 5 days to come up with a response is very challenging, and it's just in our opinion, it would be very difficult for us to do that.
Are you proposing then?
I propose that it at least match the period of time that the appellant has to prepare their actual claim. Or at a minimum, 2 weeks. But I ask those, especially for the contract and the breach of contract controversy, that we be allowed at least 60 days to respond.
I know there was a concern raised by the university in that area.
Yeah, they were requesting 10 days.
They were requesting 10 days at least.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I mean, I mirrored this after other jurisdictions because, I guess in my thinking, the agency that is supposed to be preparing this report is also the same agency that had already written the decision on the protest. So I assume they should have all their things ready to go. Well, I mean, there may be other issues that, you know, are thrown into the appeal that weren't there and you'd have to answer that somehow. But for the most part, you've got the record of the procurement, the record of the protest, and you've got your decision on the protest has to be based on something, so all those backup documents should be available. And
well, it goes beyond that. It's not like a Sunshine Act request where we're just providing documents. I mean, that's fairly easy process. So I go to the cabinet, find them, and we deliver. Now, it's also responding to allegations. For example, if they are alleging that our action is arbitrary and capricious or contrary to law, we're going to have to go hit the books, do our research, and at least in our response say, well, according to this precedent and this is why it's not. Mm-hmm. This is why we did what we did. And that takes, legal research does take some time to respond. So we're not just providing documents here. We're also making a legal response, making a legal answer to the challenge to our action. So we require a little longer and simply ask for more time, especially in the case of a contract dispute. The reason being is it's only, you know, the only interested parties are the agency and the contractor that's already been awarded the contract. And it's usually a dispute about timing or about particular rights that they may have or think they have or a breach of contract. So. Yes, we'd ask, especially for contract disputes, we'd ask for 60 days to respond to those, just like we have 60 days, or just like the appellant would have 60 days to file a response. In the Superior Court of Guam, for example, on judicial review, we would have 60 days to respond to the complaint.
I'm just going to interject my own thinking. When you say judicial, you know, the whole purpose of going through here is to make the process less onerous, mm-hmm. less judicial, kind of an expedited matter, so that things don't have to be nearly as in the exact format as the way you would prepare a brief. I'm just thinking out of what I kind of envisioned this, that this would be a simplified way of trying to decide something without all of the formality of a judicial review. And I could be wrong in how I envisioned this, but that was the whole idea, so that it would be less costly for both the appealing parties as well as for the government entity, as opposed to, you know, going to court where you have to, you know, and do all of these. And maybe I'm just a little bit maybe my thought process and maybe the actuality might be a little bit in conflict.
Yeah, speaking for GPA and GWA especially, the protest or the appeal will most likely be prepared by an attorney. Mm-hmm. It will be a legal document. Mm-hmm. These are big companies.
Yes, I recognize.
They're going to have an advantage if they have 60 days. Mm-hmm. And we only have 5 to respond to this. What will probably end up with that be a very large appeal, very clearly stating their legal grounds. Mm-hmm. And to give us 5 days to respond to that, it's not very realistic in terms of GPA and GWA. Even for some of the smaller agencies where it's a simpler type of procurement.
Yeah, and maybe we have to differentiate as to either at the dollar level or something. That, you know, because the whole idea, at least my envisioning of this, is to make it simple so that we're not using lawyers to lawyers, and each side incurring additional costs to do this. I mean, that was really kind of like a layman's way of filing an appeal that doesn't have to have all the legal language.
I think in theory, right?
In theory.
These rules are written like that, and the rules before these were written like that, but in reality, nowadays, yeah, most of these contractors hire lawyers, and they become the appeals, the protests themselves have become very judicial-like.
Yes, yeah. Very, very complex. Yeah. From the GPA and GWA, at least, and I'm certain for GSA as well.
So I expect that, and we'll consider the 5 days, because that's also been another point that's been close to us, but I'd like to get everybody's testimony on that.
And then going on, 12-104 for, and this is where I kind of hinted on this before. This is kind of expansive because it allows rebuttals by interested parties, and these are by the parties who didn't file a protest.
Yes,
I've already stated that before.
Right.
This is the one that really needs to be a rebuttal to the agency's reporter / answer. Really should be limited to the protestor, not another party, although interested, who didn't file a protest. Because they essentially, and I'm making this on due process and standing, right? They would lack standing, essentially, to participate in the hearing without filing their protest.
But if we were to cure your earlier one about the two requirements, one and two, then that would eliminate who could be an interested party.
Yes, or you could keep that there, but change this statute and say, you know, only the person who, only the appellant, you know, can file a rebuttal. Okay. Anyway. Going on real quick, it's 104C8, this says that after notice of appeal to the public auditor is filed by the head of the purchasing agency. I believe that this is another typo, or essentially, it's not for an appeal. Okay, the contractor would be the one to file the appeal because it's the agency that makes the final action, and it's the contractor who appeals that action to the OPA. So I think that this particular section should be revised to read contractor.
Yeah, if I can just comment on that, I totally agree with you, but that's why I put the source here, because I just had to mirror the statute language. I think the statute itself is identical,
it's off,
and it's off. Yeah.
So
I want to leave it in, since that's the way the statute reads. Point it out to the legislature that, you know, this
should
to
be.
Us doesn't really make that much sense.
Okay.
And we'll put your comments in as well. So hopefully then they can make an amendment to the statute.
Okay.
Yeah, but these are your regulations. So you have the authority to make them clear and make them...
But we can go beyond the statute. That would be saying the opposite of what the statute said if we did what we think.
I still submit that, just my humble opinion.
Go ahead.
With your rulemaking authority, you have the opportunity to correct that... that error that
rather than perpetuate the error in the rule. I think that's a valid point. Okay. Well,
but I leave it up to your discretion.
Sure.
Pointing it out.
Okay. That's a good point.
And then in 12-105B, agency reports, where it talks about submitting, one of the things we're supposed to submit, or one of the things the agency is supposed to submit as part of its answer is a copy of the appellant's bid. The problem we had is that under the Guam procurement law and Guam procurement regulations, information, specifically bids, can only be released at certain times. Okay. For example, in a sealed bid, the bidder's abstract, for example, isn't released until after the award of the bid. Likewise, of all the bids, only the bidder who is awarded the contract, that's the only bid that's subject to public release, and all the other bids are not. And the reason that's there is that is basically to preserve the integrity of the procurement process. And I understand also that I guess the public, the OPA has a valid interest in seeing, you know, a copy of the bid, but in other sections here, it says that, you know, all the stuff that's provided the OK is public information. I'm very sorry.
Yep.
Something should be inserted here stating that if the contract hasn't been awarded or if under procurement law it wouldn't be disclosed, even if we just... I'm sorry. Hello? No, I can't. It's not going to cut.
Anthony, what about section 12106? Do you think that doesn't adequately address that concern? Required to be held by law or regulation?
And we could cite that in there, but at the same time, in handling the records, I'm just trying to make it clear that in our answer especially, and especially this, and if it's a pending, especially if no award has been made. Okay.
But if I understand your concern, let me just, again, I want to put it for the benefit of the group here as well as myself, who is not a lawyer, okay. You're asking that if a bid has not been awarded, that the details of the bid not be open for public scrutiny, or
that's
public
correct.
Public
yeah.
disclosure.
Or at least that if the procurement rules and statutes state that they're not supposed to publicly disclose this part of the bid documents or the procurement file, that they not be publicly disclosed. But certainly if the OPA wants to look at them by law, I believe you can.
Because I do believe there is something, we've already addressed it, where there is information that is proprietary in nature, right? I think that's your concern?
Yes.
Okay, that the proprietary in nature still remain proprietary in nature. And I think there is something in the rules that we're proposing that the protester, right, has to identify that portion that is proprietary in nature, if I'm not mistaken. So the burden of proof, I guess, really belongs on the bidder or the person that, you know, to, because we even have that in other areas where it's identified, this is, and it's not to be revealed at any time. Take a moment to change our.
Your concern is the agency's handling of the documents.
That's correct. Essentially, if we're going to be disclosing information on the procurement file to the OPA, those portions which are not available for public release clearly have to be identified
right.
and made very clear that. They're not for public disclosure,
right.
although to decide the protest, certainly I will not doubt your jurisdiction to review them.
Mm-hmm.
Just so that, you know, otherwise, if they are publicly disclosed, what's bad for the agency is that essentially jeopardizes the entire procurement action, and then whenever the protest is resolved one way or the other, we'd have to go back and start it all over again, because let's say there are 10 bidders.
Mm-hmm. And they already know the information.
You know, all the information is out, and mm-hmm. they can't compete, knowing that they no longer... adequately compete because everybody knows what everybody else's bid is,
right.
then there are a lot of problems. So,
would it be satisfactory to add a provision right here in the agency report section that says that you, the agency, shall mark those types of documents or information and that we are not allowed to release that either? We'll have to put that in all different sections here. Probably.
Pursuant to the law.
Right.
So put the burden on the agency to tell us.
We could, yes.
Things that they're submitting, yeah.
That's in our act. Because it wouldn't be, now the protester could, they submit their documents, but as far as the agency action, the statute really applies to the agency. It says, agency, you will not, for example,
right.
Release any information, in a proposal, in a request
mm-hmm.
for proposal, an RFP, to anybody else, and only the proposer, the offeror who gets awarded the contract, only that proposal gets publicly released, nobody else. So. Yes, or stuff like that. Yeah.
So, going back to what Therese said, if we put the burden on the agency to decide what should be,
citing
whatever rule or law that allows you to do that, then we would take that into consideration.
Yes.
So, okay.
Yeah, we can certainly do that as part of our answer.
All right. Okay. Good. Your comments are good so far. Thank you.
Sorry I'm taking so much
time.
No, this is a long process, and I think, you know, and I apologize for that, but we'll give you opportunity, but I think, you know, we're not going to get this all right the first time, and we envision that over time, you know, it will improve, but where we can get a lot of the input and feedback from the entities, we appreciate that, and Anthony, we appreciate you taking it, the time to review this, so thank you.
Okay, and then going to 12105B, that same thing when I talked about the
right.
Distraction,
yeah.
Or certain
yeah.
things, those
yeah.
same arguments. 12107B, essentially, this is in a section that talks about ex parte communications with the OPA, or generally, you know, communications with the OPA by the parties,
right.
The agency and the appellant or the protester. Essentially, if the OPA and staff may entertain questions or complaints, I would simply ask that a provision be added that such questions or complaints and any OPA responses should be disclosed to the other parties in the appeal. That's all.
Yeah,
that
makes sense. That is relevant to this case.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, because we get a lot of other issues.
Oh,
yes,
no, just only
relevant to this. Okay.
Guam is small. We can't get away with a you know, blanket prohibition. In section 12108A, where it talks about hearing officers will determine whether a hearing is necessary for resolution of the appeal, it's our position that due process mandates that a hearing is mandatory if requested by one of the parties. I believe, for example, a protester, or even the agency, if they demand a hearing, I believe the Organic Act of Guam would require, as part of the administrative review, that party requesting the hearing be granted a hearing before any official decision is made on the appeal. It shouldn't be left up to the discretion of the hearing officer, and that's essentially part of the due process clause of the Organic Act. That states that basically the fundamental rights of the fundamental rights are at risk by some government action. The government can't take action to the parties that are afforded right to notice and hearing to respond to such action. And here, as written, if the hearing officer says, "Well, I'm just not going to grant you a hearing for whatever reason," I believe that would lead to due process or due process arguments that's wrong. You have a fundamental, it's our position that the agency and the protester have a fundamental right to a hearing. And that if they request it, it's mandatory.
Okay. You raise a valid point. What are you proposing?
That is just that part where it says hearing officer will determine whether a hearing is necessary if resolution of the appeal be omitted.
Yeah.
Or
unless
the parties, and I think it's you waive your right to a hearing.
Okay. Uh-huh. We can put that language in about the waiving your right to a hearing, and that would probably address that.
Yeah. Can I submit, you know, probably.
I think it was, intended that if no one requests a hearing, no hearing is necessary, but we'll reverse it. We'll put waive your right to a hearing. That should, that's your concern.
And I'd also go on to recommend that you have a specific form for doing so. It's just so
right.
that there's no question later on. In 12108B, hearing proceedings, this goes to your first question where you said, what's the burden of proof? Well, it says that you're not following the evidentiary guidelines. You know, these are informal proceedings and expedited proceedings, but I guess here where it just says that the weight attached to evidence presented in any particular form will be within the discretion of the hearing officer. That's kind of a very broad brush. Really, there's no identification of who has the burden of proof. And I guess if you're going to leave that language as is, I'd ask that you follow the Supreme Court of the United States decision in Chevron versus NRDC, That's 487 U.S. 837, where it says that deference should be given to an agency's interpretation of the law if it is reasonable. That's essentially the reasonableness test. Essentially, if we interpret the procurement statute and regulation one way, and it's reasonable, some deference needs to be given to that, because we're the ones, the agencies are the ones that have to enact the statute and implement it on a day-to-day basis.
I understand your comments, but where in D would we make the change? Because the weight to be attached presented in any question form will be within the discretion of the hearing. So are you, so where in 2108D would we make the change? Hearings, because we say in here shall be informal, the testimony shall be written, the weight to be attached.
I think, yeah, this is what you're referring to in the Chevron case. If that's going to be included, it's going to have to go somewhere else. Not necessarily towards how the evidence is going to be reviewed, but interpretation of the law, right?
Yeah, or you can just say, you know, deference should be given to the agency's interpretation of the law if it's reasonable. That's all. I guess if you really go into the Chevron case, they have very specific, you know, there's a very specific definition of the reasonableness test, which is accepted on Guam and all other 50 states and territories. And then in...
But going back to D, then you're just making a statement that we should consider that, but you're not proposing any change in the proposed rule.
I'd actually request that some statement...
be added.
Yeah, closely tracking that language.
Okay.
Deference should be given to agency's interpretation of the law if it's reasonable.
Okay. Statement be added, huh?
Be put in there either, you know, the last sentence in the paragraph
uh-huh.
or is a different section altogether.
Okay.
And then 12108H, disclosure. Once again, I already discussed that, you know, in terms
yeah.
of, you know, parts that are,
mm-hmm.
the procurement file that are not disclosable at certain times. And 12109H1, when you talk about sanctions, disobedient parties, essentially parties that are not listening to the orders of the OPA, I believe that we're, instead of the language where it states refusing to allow a disobedient party to support or oppose designated claims or defenses, it should be revised to read, you know, basically, I think the sanction is talking about is dismissal of the action or dismissal of their defense. That's just a matter of semantics, though. That's all. The sanction of dismissal in court, for example, was very well recognized. Likewise, you know, the sanction of dismissal at your level would also be also recognized. 12501A, this is my last one. This is essentially 12501A, that applies to, I'm trying to put it in layman's terms here, when a protest is filed, the agency can make a determination to proceed with the award of the contract despite the protest. Essentially, you know, there's no stay if the significant interests of the territory are at stake. And here, in 5, and that comes from 5 GCA section 5425G. The regulation is a little expansive here because if you go to the statute says that only the party, essentially, only the protestor need be given notice of that type of determination. And that ostensibly allows the protestor then to go to court or go to the OPA and file the appropriate documents to oppose that. Here, once again, with the interested party language,
yeah,
that would
right.
allow anybody, you know,
yeah.
to include whether there's 10 bidders
yeah.
and only one
yeah.
other
no, person. I have to say I totally agree with you. That's a typo here, because this is a totally different type of party that we need in this case. So, yes, I can say with confidence that one for sure will be amended.
Okay.
That one should only be
closed. Yeah, I just have to keep closely track the statute.
Okay.
Once again, I know it's taken a lot of time.
No, not at all. We appreciate you, and in fact, maybe if there's any other additional comments you'd like to make, please turn them in for us. We will be taking testimony up till about 10 days now.
Yeah, I think it's about 7 days.
June 7th?
Sorry, I didn't calculate what that date
is. We'll post it on the website. We'll post it on the website tomorrow that we will still be taking comments up till. Okay.
And I want to thank you once again for your great work, and certainly thank you for the notice of the hearing and the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you very much. You're the one who has to implement.
So we appreciate you having.
Okay. All right. After Anthony Camacho, before that, if anyone needs copies or
of his testimony,
I think there aren't any of that. But
do we need more copies of the rules?
If anyone needs copies made,
okay. There's that. Oh, still? Okay.
If you need more copies,
I think we have enough, right? Okay. Does anybody want copies of his? We'll make a few more copies. Okay. All right. Okay, we'll make a few more copies.
Does anyone else want copies of their testimony made right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, if you're going to give us, please, and we'll make copies so that others can have them available.
Okay. We'll have Lou Paris and Claudia. If you can both come up. Sorry about the tight quarters.
Yeah. We realized afterward, we thought when we got this place it was big, because we realized for a public area it may not be. Okay. Thank you, and it's now approximately 2:55, and we are hearing testimony from our next citizens. If you could just state for the record your name and your position, and then go into your testimony.
Okay. Lynn Paris, Director, Department of Administration, and I have with me Claudia Foggy, Chief Procurement Officer, General Services Agency.
Thank you very much for coming. And
We just got a lot of communication. Yes. First of all, I just wanted to start by also commending your office for coming up with a much needed and much awaited procurement to appeals their rules and regulation. GS General Services Agency of the Government of Guam does on occasion receive protests, and we feel for the protesters that they feel that maybe they have not been fully heard to the extent that is allowed. It looks like their only other option was to go to court if they did not agree with the determination of either the procurement officer, chief procurement officer, or the agency. So it happens to be the procuring officer for request for proposal. So we feel this is a very good thing, and we're happy for the opportunity to review your proposed rules and regs, and also I believe there is some suggested language in terms of a statute that you're asking the legislature to consider amending. So with that, we're happy. Claudia and I are happy to be here. We do have some very, just a short, a few items that we ask that you consider in prior to actually formally sending the rules and regs over to the Guam legislature. And before Claudia goes through some of the detail, and we'll go very quickly because it basically echoes some of the concerns mm-hmm. that the previous witness, Mr. Camacho, had stated, and I'm happy for the legal opportunity to listen to the legal concerns on some of this. I do encourage the public auditor to suggest changes to statute that we already see there are some conflicts. So, and I know you've been receiving those directly, as you stated when you opened the hearing. So.
If you have any other suggestions that you might also see, please transmit that to us so that we can try to get as many of those changes in as possible so the legislature has an opportunity. So we appreciate your feedback in those areas because you deal with it more
That's
than
right.
we do and can see those inconsistencies of mm-hmm. law. And therefore, I think your testimony will have greater weight because you're dealing it on a day-to-day basis. Okay. So we would appreciate getting that.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I'll go ahead and ask the Chief Attorney Officer to outline some of just of concerns as to the proposed language.
Okay. We share the same concern with Tony Camacho's testimony on 12102. And what we're saying there is, or what I've suggested was where it says that the public auditor shall have the power to review and determine. And what I added there was whether there was substantial evidence to uphold the determination made by the Chief Procurement Officer. The Director of Public Works or the Head of Purchasing Agency. Because I'm assuming here at this point, please, that the appellant, right, of course, if the only reason why they would appeal to the OPA's office is if they were not satisfied with the decision of the Chief Procurement Officer.
Right.
So in line with that, of course, their appeal will be on the same basis of their protest, because then otherwise it's going to go out of alignment here.
Right.
So their focus should still be on the same basis of their protest and case submitted.
Okay.
So and that's why I was saying there. I just suggested for that just a minor change here, whether to determine whether there was substantial evidence to uphold the determination made by the CPO, the Director of Public Works, or the head of a purchasing agency.
Let me just ask you again, just as an observation, okay, and I'm coming in here again with no preconceived notion. You've made a determination to give it to Company A. Company B protested because they feel that they should have won it. And so they will file the protest. Then you're going to make a determination saying, no, you disagree with Company B. Mm-hmm. It still goes to Company A. So that's why then Company B will come to our office mm-hmm. to protest, saying that they disagreed with the decision, because you made the determination and you know. So until my concern here was whether there was substantial evidence to uphold the determination, we really won't know this until we look at all
the provided. We'll be provided.
Right.
Further down.
Yeah. Okay. So that's my comment here. This really won't happen until all the evidence is submitted.
And it's okay.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And all right. On 12104A, the second sentence, where it says there, be deleted because the agency cannot prevent the appellant. It says here that electronic filing may also be allowed and available and approved by the agency. But we can't prevent them from filing an appeal, right?
Well, yeah, what I meant there is the OPA.
OPA. The intent here was really, as we move into the electronic age, rather than having paper, and that was meant to be the OPA.
Okay.
Because we're new to this process, we're still in the paper stage.
Okay.
So at some point, we will allow people to file electronically, just like the court is in the process of doing some of that,
mm-hmm.
so that we will eventually move to that level mm-hmm. also. So that should have been OPA.
Okay. 12104B, this is a question actually we're posing.
Sure.
And again, because we deal, I deal with process a lot.
Sure.
Down in our office. We just wanted to, is the failure to do the minimum in the form and filing of an appeal grounds for automatic denial of the appeal, for example, labeling the envelope appeal? Because in the case of protest, right, mm-hmm. even if we get it to a fax,
mm-hmm.
a fax copy, and then the original will be submitted later,
mm-hmm.
We still entertain it because it is still a protest. So we just wanted to make sure that there's something in there that, about denying it or...
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. I have to say the answer's not written in here.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll try to put the answer in there. I think I thought about, we just want to label it so it doesn't get mixed up with any other business here. That's the most number one concern. I'm sure you have to think about it.
Because
right now it looks like the only reason why you can deny it is because it did not meet the filing period.
Right, that's correct.
In my own dealing with procurement, as we've evaluated, sometimes we find that things are denied because of what I call substance of the form. Mm-hmm. The form was submitted, but yet substantively everything was there. Yeah. And so where there, if they forgot to check off something, to me, I don't feel that that should be a denial.
Yeah.
When substantively the whole package was complete.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not looking to disqualify someone merely for a, you know, a technicality.
Right. Especially if it's in the best interest of the
government.
Yes, right. Yes, and we do make those determinations. We weigh those out.
Yeah. So that's just from my own experience, too, that I have seen that sometimes, and we want to discourage that.
Yeah.
But if substantively it does have an effect, you know, then, you know.
I've seen it by statute.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, 1204C3, we're recommending to, to indicate the chief of the office, the director of public works, and the head of the purchasing agency shall submit to the public auditor a complete copy of the procurement file relevant to the appeal within 5 working days of receiving notice of an appeal. Okay, I know earlier Tony stated, you know, to be allowed to have more time to file records or the documents to the OPA's office, which I would agree, because, you know, in their case, it may vary.
Mm-hmm. How many days are you suggesting?
The way we first saw this was kind of informal, in that we provide the complete procurement file,
mm-hmm.
and from there you determine whether you think there's actually the accusations can be upheld, and then you will have a hearing. So we don't really foresee calling our attorney at this point in this process.
Sure.
We give you the files, you determine if there's some regulation or rule or process we did not follow, mm-hmm. which gives credence to the appellant's claim.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
if we do engage the services of the Attorney General, I'm not sure whether the 5 working days is going to be adequate either.
The way you've written the procurement file, that I think should be able to be made available in 5 days. And
that's how
I originally wrote this, and then I changed it because I thought we really don't need everything in that file.
Mm.
What's required in the statute to be put in a procurement file is a lot, and I'm thinking sometimes the appeal might be on a, you know, lesser issue that doesn't really require all of that. But I thought I was a little bit shortcutting there to allow you less duplicate all of that, you know, copies of, audio testimony, of your deliberations, things like that. But so those are two different things. Yes, I think we've allowed you to submit less than the entire working file,
mm-hmm.
but I agree that if the submitting the documents, my original thinking was 5 days is more than enough time. But yeah, if you're going to submit an answer, the Attorney General should submit an answer, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
I think it's a disservice to you to not have, if you have the attorneys on the other side protesting,
allowed our attorney.
But
more time.
You could have to work that out with him, and we'll consider the 5 days. We're going to consider that 5 days.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. Yeah,
so
we also don't want to delay it anymore than necessary,
right.
Because some of these, you know, we would like to proceed, of course.
Because as long as it's in protest, it's
safe.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay. So I hear two comments relative to this, that giving us the file within 5 working days is not onerous to anyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can produce the file or whatever is relevant in the file for us. Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's number one. And so that's not a problem. But then if you had to file a formal answer,
mm-hmm.
that's the one that requires a little bit more time, may require a little bit more time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And 1204-4,
mm-hmm.
I'm just recommending to delete that because, again, it's in line with item 3, with the time element, right, the 10 days, and then it goes to a 5-day again. So it's just like a redundancy of the 3.
Oh, well, the 10 days is comments from the other people.
Uh-huh.
You get to submit your report in 5 days.
Okay.
10 days after that.
It's for the interested.
Yes.
Okay.
Or the opposing party to submit. Yeah. Then you get 5 days to rebut it.
Okay. One of the things that we will do, I've asked Therese to do, is to kind of maybe as an attachment, a proposed timeline to figure, so people will see, okay, the post has this file on this, this is what has to happen,
yes.
And so on. So kind of like
a highlight
of a chronology.
Yes.
And she's in the process of preparing that, so that, and we'll attach that as part of this, so that way people will have a general idea of what is the timeline.
Okay.
So we would not want to delete number 4.
No.
Because
you
yeah.
Add
okay.
More the
yeah.
Appellant
mm-hmm.
response.
Right. Okay.
Okay. 1-104-6. This is the public auditor shall, upon request, make available or recommending after a decision has been made. Because it doesn't indicate when, at what time, or at what point.
Oh, good.
The document will be made available. And in order to avoid your disruption and having to put a decision together,
mm-hmm.
you know, by everybody just coming in at any time to request for these
mm-hmm.
files or documents or information, I'm recommending that after a decision has been made by the Office of the Public Auditor to, again, you know, whoever wants to request, it becomes
mm-hmm.
public record after that.
Our actual, thank you for pointing, our intent afterwards is to also post the decisions on the web. Okay, so that way everybody has, in addition to formally notifying, we will first formally notify the parties
mm-hmm.
of the decision, and then after the notification, then we will post it. That way anyone has access, and we're in the process of preparing a whole area just for the procurement appeals so that people will know what is being appealed, what the status is, where we are in the appeals process. Okay. So we're looking at avenues like that, and we're using the web so that that way it's open and everybody has information.
Can I just point something out to you and Anthony, and if you guys could help me justify this, you know, it doesn't have to be right now, but in 5GCA 5703, it says, the public auditor may consider testimony and evidence submitted by any competing bidder, offer, or contractor of the protestant. That's why we try to allow them access at every point, right? But I know that the issues of, you know, confidentiality of the bid, the proposals, things like that have to be addressed. But, you know, otherwise I think, you know, we have to be inclined to leave it open at almost every point. They can't respond, they can't submit comments unless they know what the appeal is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have to allow them copies of that.
Well, yes, I tend to, with Tony's earlier statement about the bids, you know, from a confidential, but there's a distinguishment between the proposals and the actual, you know, the bid, invitation for bid and
mm-hmm.
the request for proposals. Because, yes, on a request for proposal, the only document that can be released is to the awarding offeror.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only one. Everything
mm-hmm.
else remains confidential.
Mm-hmm.
But on a bidder, on an invitation for bid, or still bid, it's open.
Mm-hmm.
All the bids, unless they're all open.
Bids are open bids, so
right.
they can all come in and hear everybody else's
yes.
fight.
Right.
But on a request for proposal,
mm-hmm.
that's where it differs.
Okay.
Because on a request for proposal, the only information or the only documents that can be released or become public records is the one that's awarded
mm-hmm.
the contract.
I appreciate your point in terms of avoid delay, and yeah, so we'll just have to keep this all in mind.
Yeah,
we've also had experience dealing with protests that have
mm-hmm.
gone to the courts where some of the information we allowed
mm-hmm.
the protester is actually being challenged now that we should never have disclosed it.
Oh,
because then it puts the one that was
competing bidders.
That's right. It's all pricing, you know,
right.
And
yes.
and then it just
mm-hmm.
we're just continually just going to court about all these.
You're referring to like one mass transit.
Yeah, 3 years in protest and
yeah.
still not resolved.
Yeah.
So
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's been very
uh-huh.
hard for us to try to award that contract.
Mm-hmm. I thought the decision was made already.
It's actually awaiting. There's a request for reconsideration.
Just for the record, that would not ever come to us now because
mm-hmm.
once
that's
it's
right.
in court, it's already
yeah.
barred.
Yeah.
Okay, just the moment someone files officially with the court, this office no longer has jurisdiction. So even any subsequent things regarding that,
as long as it's semi-original.
Yeah, we, and thank God.
What bill do you go by now as to do you go through by the statute what can be released, not released, when you're dealing with the protest, and what do you release?
Okay, only if an award is on an RFP, if it has been awarded, and we don't have a protest, then that is releasable information, but only for the one that has been awarded.
Mm-hmm. But when there is a protest?
If there is a protest,
What do you do in those situations?
When there is a protest, we have those questions arising on whether some of that, unless they specifically put in, and they do have that opportunity to say this is proprietary and confidential.
Right, we say that in our audit proposals too, that you have to identify it first up front, what is proprietary, because if you don't, then the whole RFP is public.
I'm not really sure, and I'm hoping that the written responses we get received from the agents maybe addresses those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure until I haven't had a chance to review his recommendation.
One of the things that I'm seeing, though, just since we're talking about procurement in general, one of the things I'm seeing is that more and more entities are using an RFP when they should not be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that I think was the basis of the comment.
Because
what constitutes professional services versus services,
definition.
Yeah, and that's where I'm seeing a little bit more use of the RFP, maybe inappropriately.
We're recommending that maybe in your transmittal, recommend some changes. Because it should not be the government agency.
And I think Tony's comment and your is well taken. If we know, for in fact, the law is definitely in error, maybe our rule should be changed to be more inclined, what I call plain English.
All right. Teresa, can we go on to British State on the confidentiality?
Yes.
See, I know that the statute doesn't make mention where if you, we have to advise, even if it's a request of proposal to the offeror, that if they're getting the award, if they're going to be awarded the contract, that documents become public records.
With the exception of they've acknowledged before. Maybe I'm going to ask for clarification. And I know this specifically because when we do the RFP for audit services,
mm-hmm.
we do say in the RFP that if there's any section in there that you determine to be proprietary, that you must so state so, and that the entity still has to make a determination whether or not they agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if the entity disagrees with that, they notify the offeror, and then the offeror may decide to either retrieve it. Okay?
Right.
So that is my understanding.
Right? Just need to look up into the statutes with that confidentiality.
Yeah.
Just a statement of that.
Mm-hmm.
That prior to awards, they should be advised that if it's confidential in their solicitation,
right.
that it will have to be exposed.
And
if they don't want it, then they would have to.
Right.
Thank you very much.
That was short. Okay. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your testimony, Claudia. Thank you very much,
thank
too.
You.
All right. Who is next?
Anita Cruz and Jolene Evangelista.
No
testimony?
No.
Okay. Jolene, no.
Okay.
All right. Jesse Regis? Testimony? Okay.
Anyone else would like to submit testimony?
Okay. Sure. You hear more as observers?
I'm from Bombard School.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Uh-huh. All right. And
the father from the square.
GPA.
Okay. Oh,
you're also.
Okay. Any questions
or comments from what has been presented? And you're with?
Quantel.
power of, okay, to, okay. GPA is well supported.
If I may ask, you know, we have a provision in here when the public auditor has to recuse, that we really, I mean, the statute doesn't allow any other alternative, so we wrote that it's going to go to court, but we would like to propose that the legislature come up with an alternative. And I'd like to solicit your comments, if anyone has any, on what that alternative should be.
Right now, it's just to go to court, right?
Because, yeah, there's no... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we were having some discussions. I think we did answer, for example, in the event that Therese has to recuse herself, we put in there that then I could go and hire. Okay. Okay. I could hire another attorney, and I think we'll be soliciting for attorneys who, as a list of who might be available. So in Teresa's case, there's an opportunity that in the event she has to recuse herself, she can. What happens in my case if I have to recuse myself? And that's a we don't know yet what should happen.
Possibly that.
Yes, that was one exactly is in our Enabling Act 1909, where we select the auditor, okay, and I make that determination, okay, because our court case was reaffirmed in the retirement court case where the judge, Judge Manabusan, said the public auditor has to make the decision. So in that particular case where I made the decision, and let's say a CPA firm protests that, because I have made the decision, although who then will become
any thoughts? Anyone? Yeah. Well, right now that's what it looks like. So
one other
legislature asked, I wanted to be able to say we've heard, you know, these types of comments and these types of proposals.
One thing I have suggested to Therese is where she feels that she can make the determination herself without, you know, that she go ahead and do it, where I have to recuse myself. She becomes so it prevents it going to court, you know, one more time. Yeah. Other than just going to court directly because I have to recuse myself in the event where, like in, that she be the final determiner, because in all practicality, I'm going to rely 99 and 9/10 on what she says.
There are
many
factors
we need
to consider there.
It would be inappropriate, like in that case,
That's the only one that I know for certain that, you know, where we make the determination. But then there might be other instances, let's just say hypothetically, like if we made a determination in awarding something from our own office operation, right, mm-hmm. then, you know, who would make that review, you know. Not that we buy a lot of stuff, but still, you know, you have to, you know, again, we go to great pains to make sure everything is done correctly, but still there could be that, you know, feeling. And who would be the appropriate hearing determinant of making that?
Thank you again, everyone. And just a reminder, when these are submitted to legislature, legislature will also supposedly have a public hearing on what they're going to do with it. And so you also have additional time to comment there. Mm-hmm. Or you can submit anything to us in 7 days. We'll pass it on to them or incorporate it if, you know, it merits that. And again, thank you very, very much.
Just as a summary, yeah, our target is to finalize everything and submit it to the legislature on or before June 30th. That way, they have the 90 days. And it's our hope that within the 90 days, that come October 1 with the new budget act, it will be blessed, and then effective October 1, we can then be open for hearing any protest after that time.
Okay.
That's really the goal of what we want to do, is to be operational by October 1. But again, we can't predict what the legislature will do. But they deserve the opportunity also for 90 days.
Okay.
So thank you so much, everyone. We appreciate you taking the time. I will now officially close this public hearing as of 3:25. Thank you so much.